second to the National Organizational Secretary of the SWC.
Thank you. I said thank you. Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends, on my way to camp from New York, I read a short brochure published by the United Electrical Workers Union, which had been one of the groups that had been expelled from the CIO in 1948 as being communist-dominated, and who are now an independent union not affiliated to the AFL-CIO. The title of the pamphlet is The Decline of the AFL-CIO, an address to the UE 27th International Convention at Long Beach, California, August 30, 1962, by Frank J. Donner, the UE General Counsel. Now, as indicated by the title, this is only one of a whole number of similar pamphlets, articles, and books published in the recent period, some deploring, some chortling over the decline in the influence of the American labor movement, especially since the period of the 30s. Even Reuther on occasion, Carey, and Meany when he's had a little too much to drink, are prone to deplore the absence of the old crusading spirit of the social vision that presumably characterized the labor movement under their leadership in bygone years. Let me read one of the opening paragraphs in this pamphlet to indicate to you the type of thinking that's going on in these circles. Donner says, and I quote, "The evidence now available to all of us shows that not only is the AFL-CIO falling apart, but that the process is irreversible and continuing. It cannot be arrested as long as the present leadership and the philosophy of the movement continue in the ascendancy. The evidence shows that the collapse of the organized labor movement, the collapse of the organized labor movement, is not due to the existence of new problems which defy solution, such as hostile legislation or automation, but because of certain inherent policies and weaknesses of the movement itself." Now, we can agree with Donner that there is an inherent weakness both in policy and practice of the leadership of the American Union movement. His solution, of course, is to substitute for it the leadership of the present UE. I don't want to deprecate the UE because we have a staunch member here of the organization, and it does have some advantages over some of the outfits in the AFL-CIO. But in the whole pamphlet, he offers nothing new, nothing more, nothing other than what we've been offered by the present leadership of the union move. And I can sum up in one small phrase all that is required to introduce that change which would completely alter the character of the union movement and again set it on the road of a crusading social force capable of leading the American working class to victory over capitalism in this strongest center of world capitalism, the United States. All they have to do is to substitute a policy of class struggle for a policy of class collaboration, and the union movement would be transformed, period. And by class collaboration, I mean essentially the concept that there is an identity of interest between the employer and the worker. That all that is required is to sit down around the conference table and work out the occasional differences that may arise from time to time, especially at contract bargaining periods. And if both are reasonable, arrive at a satisfactory arrangement of how the wealth, the national income of the country, shall be divided between those who work, those who labor, those who produce, and those who own and control the means of production, the capitalist class. Recently, the head of the communication workers, what is his name? Bernie, wrote a book which received a very favorable press in the capitalist press, New Horizons for American Labor, in which, in essence, he concludes that such proletarian means of struggle as the strike have been outmoded. And what is necessary is for the labor leadership to exercise labor statesmanship to advance the aims and goals of labor and of American society in general. The trouble is the union movement is so goddamn sick of labor statesmanship that much more of it and Donner's prediction is likely to come true. Now we'll examine in the course of looking at the development of the labor movement from the New Deal to the New Frontier, the stages in its development. What line of action proved effective and what has happened since the period following World War II, the last big upsurge of labor in the post-war period. First, some of the comrades on the lawn were remarking about the controversy between Bertrand Russell and the New York Times over the question of Vietnam. And if you've read The Militant, The Militant carried a comment by George Meany, who referred to Russell as the so-called philosopher. Let me read to you a statement that Meany made in a speech before the National Association of Manufacturers, in which he was a guest speaker. Quote, "It may interest you to know," says Meany, "that I never went on strike in my life. I never ran a strike in my life. I never ordered anyone to run a strike in my life, and never had anything to do with a picket line." Period, unquote. Now, if that doesn't describe a so-called labor leader, by his own words and in the most eloquent terms, Now to go back to the New Deal. A great deal of the kind of talk that we hear today about the labor movement being dead or dying or incapable of performing any historical role was heard in the period prior to the New Deal, in the 20s. At that time, many radicals, communists, wobblies and others, were convinced that it would be easier in this country to make the social revolution than to organize the workers of the mass production industry in steel, auto, rubber, etc. So formidable, so impossible appeared this task that they were convinced and argued that we would have the social revolution in this country and skip over the stage of mass trade unionism. It was the period of the American plan, that is, the period of company unionism, which carried to its ultimate the concept of the identity of interest between employer and employee, where each company would form its own union and would bargain, in quotes, for fringe benefits. I remember I belonged to such a union when I worked for Western Electric. Some of the benefits we got was at noon we would have a band playing in the yard. They had the Hawthorne shop where we could buy commodities at a discount. In the summertime, we would have a picnic now and then. All of which to demonstrate how we were all just one big, happy family. I quit the job after I worked there for 2 years. After 2 years, they suddenly announced that they were eliminating what they called the war rate. During the period of the First World War, like they did in the Second World War, instead of increasing your wages, they added to the basic wage what they called a war rate. Well, in 1921, obviously the war was over. There was no further justification for a war rate, so they announced they were eliminating the war rate. Incidentally, it amounted to a cut in wages of $2 a week at the time. So at that point, I says, well, we're all happy together. I'm going to miss the music and the discounts and the picnics, but I think we must part company. I'm not getting ahead fast enough in this industry. And working for this company. That was something of the general condition during that period. Prior to 1933-34, there were some 2 million organized workers in the country, all in the AFL or independent, I'm not counting the company unions, composed largely of the aristocrats of labor, the building trades, the metal trades, electricians, and so forth and so on. Ruled by a gang of unconscionable bureaucrats, no different essentially than what you have today, dominated by the concept of business unionism, get as much as they can for their own little group of workers, shake down the bosses occasionally, stifle any thought of any internal union democracy, and generally getting along okay. In 1933, when Roosevelt was inaugurated, January, the country was in the depths of a mortal crisis. The bank holiday had been declared, all the banks in the country closed. It was very painful then. I remember a story going around at the time about a fellow who came into a bank to draw out his savings, and the teller slammed the door in his face and said, "We're bankrupt, the bank is closed." And he was outraged and he protested. He says, teller says, "Well, why should you be so outraged? This has happened to you before, hasn't it?" He says, "Yes." He says, "I've had some of my banks go bankrupt, but I've never had one close in my face before." There were banks who would open on a Saturday and give all kinds of clocks, like they do now, clocks and things, who would close on Monday. Industry was prostrated. Employment had reached phenomenal heights. And Roosevelt undertook the chore which he accomplished successfully of bailing out the capitalist system, saving the capitalist system. Under federal supervision and guarantees, the banks were reopened. Policy of stimulating artificial scarcity by plowing under cotton, corn, etc., was indicated on the basis of granting subsidies. Industry was subsidized in order to compensate for this very lush policy of resuscitating American capitalism. Roosevelt was compelled to make a gesture towards the American working class, which he did in Section 7A of the National Labor Relations Act. Section 7A ostensibly gave the American workers the right to designate unions of their own choosing and to bargain collectively for a country. Now, they were given that right on paper. But in order to make it a reality, the unions had to fight every step of the way in mass struggle to achieve what ostensibly Roosevelt had granted them in Section 7A. The first big turn in the union movement came in 1934. The economy had begun to recover because of the New Deal measures. Workers who had long been employed began to flock back into the factories, and their aspirations, their hopes for a more secure life manifested itself in a movement towards unionization. It took the form of an attempting to utilize the existing union structure, the AFL, but there they ran up against this case-hardened gang of craft union bureaucrats who refused to admit them as first-class citizens without breaking them up into all kinds of little crafts, organizing on the basis of craft instead of industry, opposition to industrial unionism. The first successful strikes were led by radicals. The Minneapolis Teamsters strike of 1934 by the Trotskyists. The West Coast Maritime strikes of 34 by a combination of communist workers, IWW, some Trotskyists, and some left-wing socialists. The Toledo Light Strike of 1934, again by the American Workers' Party, the Mustiites, with which the Communist League of America, as the Trotskyist organization was then known, fused in order to form the Workers' Party in 1935. Now, what characterized all of these struggles was the application of the method of class struggle. In Minneapolis, for example, in the Teamsters strike, the comrades, recognizing the role of the state and the fact that they could depend only upon the organized power of the workers, set up a organization on a war footing. They had their own hospitals, their own flying squadrons, their own detachments to send to points of trouble anywhere in the city, their own headquarters, their own dispatching system. And they fought the struggle through as though it were a war, and it was a war. And emerged successful and established Teamsters Local 544, a branch of the Teamsters Union. In Toledo, the comrades of the American Workers' Party, the Mustyites, were in the head of an unemployed movement. The strike of the Toledo auto workers looked as though it was lost. The courts had issued an injunction. Strikers were being arrested. It looked as though the state and the employers were going to be successful in defeating the strike. They called upon the unemployed movement, and the workers in the unemployed movement flocked by the thousands to the picket line, defied the injunction, established a mass picket line, and said, "You put us in jail, you're going to have to jail all of us. We're going to pay no attention to your injunction." And they won the strike. Mass struggle and class struggle. On the West Coast, the same process took place. Roosevelt's right-hand man was a fellow by the name of General Johnson. They used to call him Iron Pants Johnson. He was sent to the West Coast in order to try and get the longshoremen and seamen back to work on the basis of arbitration. They rejected it. They fought the cops, the National Guard, the federal government, the employers to a standstill. Johnson went down to the University of California at Berkeley to recruit scabs from among the students to work cargo on the waterfront in an attempt to break the strike. And many of them, unfortunately, many of them responded. It was at this point that the Teamsters, who were not part of the strike, declared in sympathy and support of the strike and said they would not handle any cargo from any of the struck piers on the Embarcadero, the San Francisco waterfront, which meant that cargo piled up. While they had enough scabs to work cargo, they couldn't move it from the piers. An embargo was declared. The ships had to back up. The harbor was full of ships, and they finally had to capitulate, in the course of which a number of workers were killed, as they were in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis, in the struggle to establish their own independent union. Now, this process was repeated during the whole period of the formation of the CIO in one big mass strike after another. It reached its apex in the developing the technique of the sit-down, where because out of fear of the workers recruiting scabs to operate the plants, the workers sat down in the factory, just took over the factory. It was the first challenge to capital, to the holy right of capital property. And what a howl of anguished outrage emanated from all of the capitalists and their pundits throughout the country. This is revolution, they said. But the workers wouldn't and couldn't be budged, and finally, General Motors capitulated and then the rest of them had to fall in line. During this whole period, what characterized the strike movement of the early period, the 30s, was the single demand, not for wages or working conditions, but union recognition. That was the one demand that dominated the entire strike movement from one part of the country to another. Union recognition. It was only after they had gained union recognition in these struggles that they were able, through the further elaboration of their organization, to go on from there to acquire concessions in both wages and working conditions. In the process of these strikes, a new leadership arose, and a split occurred in the American labor movement, and the CIO was formed. And most of the leaders came up out of the ranks in the CIO. True, figures like John L. Lewis played a heroic role. And for peculiar, particular reasons, Lewis was able to play such a role. But essentially, it was the rank and file militants, the leaders of the picket squads, of the flying squads, of the most active strikers, that it was out of this strata that a new leadership arose in the CIO of these unions. Now, unfortunately, the movement was aborted. Aborted in the sense that from the very beginning, implicit in this gigantic eruption of the American working class, in which for the first time there was established in this country a genuine mass union organization, it stopped short at the union level. It was here that the leadership was able to play a treacherous role. That is, upon this whole movement, in motion, in action, on the basis of the methods and concepts of the class struggle, they impose a class collaborationist political policy, support for the Democratic Party. That was fatal. They were able to play that role because of the treachery of the Communist Party at that time, which had emerged from its third period, in which it had set out to organize pure revolutionary trade unions, split the union movement wide open, to the People's Front period, in which they subordinated the independent struggle of the working class to the Roosevelt administration. While they broke with the previous Gompers political policy, the movement never was able to go beyond the barriers erected by the leadership, both from the old conservative AFL and the Communist Party, which at that time was the largest radical movement in this country. And then with the war itself in 1938, if you remember, there was another downturn and the beginning of another wave of a radicalized movement, which was then aborted by the outbreak of the war in Europe in 1939. And then they were confronted, that is the union movement and its leadership, with the real test, their attitude towards the war. The question... of whether they were going to remain as an independent force advancing the aims and interests of the workers, or whether they were going to subordinate the interests of the workers to the winning of the war. And most of the leaders failed that test. We, for example, worked very closely with a union leader named Lundberg, who was a syndicalist, a European syndicalist, not of the wobbly type, and who became head of the Sailors Union of the Pacific, later became head of the Seafarers International Union, and played a very progressive role in fighting against any attempt on the part of the government to infringe upon the independence of the unions. With the outbreak of the war, his lack of understanding of the capitalist state and its role in society led him first to compromise and then capitulate to the war machine. His compromise took a very peculiar form, I remember. The question came up of the no-strike pledge. All the Stalinists, of course, at that time, as this was 1941, December, after Hitler had invaded the Soviet Union, at that time they were not only for the no-strike pledge, they were for surrendering everything that the unions had won. They were the only tendency in the working class movement, as an aside, the only tendency in the labor movement. I mean the only, and I take in here the leaders, the conservative leaders of the labor movement, that came out in support of a Roosevelt proposal to institute what he called a National Selective Service Act, that is to conscript labor to be sent to whatever area and whatever plant the decided on by the government. Anyway, to get back to this point, the compromise was, so there was no question about them accepting the no-strike pledge. That was the period in which Bridges, who was one of their major spokesmen in the union movement on the West Coast, came out with the declaration that unions must be converted into instruments of the speed-up. That was the function of unions. When the Montgomery Ward workers went on strike, they were part of Bridges' union, he called the strikers scabs, finks, and those who broke the strike were patriots. Everything was turned upside down. At any rate, Lundberg was confronted with a dilemma. It was contrary to all of his whole past and his principles as a syndicalist to accept from the government the edict that there shall be no strike, to do it voluntarily. So he said, he finally said, well, we will not surrender the right to strike. That's against our principles. But what we will do is surrender the right to exercise the right to strike. You get the distinction? Neither did I. That's when we parted company. During the whole period of the war, and especially in the latter period of the war, there developed a militant movement, a left-wing tendency inside of the union movement, especially in the CIO, which had not then been completely bureaucratized, against the whole policy of class collaboration as exemplified in the no-strike pledge, a movement that, as the struggle continued, as the war continued, grew larger, especially in such unions as the United Automobile Workers, and especially after the defiance of Lewis against the government and his miners, if you remember. They struck in 43, defied the Supreme Court, and they imposed something like a $300,000 fine on the miners' union for violating the government edict against striking. And it was about that time, let's say at the height of the movement against the whole policy of class collaboration exemplified in the no-strike pledge, that the war ended. Now, with the end of the war, American imperialism attempted to utilize the troops that it had abroad to carry out, to cash in on the imperialist victory in the war. However, they developed a movement of bring the boys back home, both in the States and in the Army. What's his name in the UAW? Amil Mazie. He became very infamous at that time as the leaders of as the leader of the he was in the Army of this movement to bring the boys back home. And they were compelled to do so. They were compelled to bring the troops back home. And this explains, for example, one of the reasons why, in my opinion, the Soviet Union, the Stalinists, were able in Eastern Europe to establish the buffer states without armed intervention by the imperialist powers. France, if you remember, was prostrate. In France, the dominant sections of the bourgeoisie had capitulated to Hitler. The underground was in power, actually, and through a coalition handed the power back to the bourgeoisie. In Italy, the bourgeoisie had been Mussolini fascist since 1921. With the overthrow of fascism, the mass movement in Italy rallied around the banner of the Communist Party, thinking that this was the most radical and advanced party, again played the same role through a coalition government of handing the power back to the Italian capitalist class. At any rate, with the return of the troops back home, the Stalinists again came up with a new version of their coexistence line. You remember there'd been a whole series of international conferences at Dumbarton Oaks, at Bretton Woods, at Casablanca, at Tehran, at a number of places, all in which the Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill had reached their agreement on carving up the spoils of victory. They came back and they said that the class struggle is now outmoded. The class struggle is outmoded because through the various pacts which have been signed between the Soviet Union and Western imperialism, there was ensured a indefinite period of the flowering of prosperity and of all good things which would come out of this new close relationship that had been cemented between the Soviet Union, the United States, and the other imperialist power. And they codified this in what they called the permanent no-strike pledge. That is, they came out and says the Union should sign with the employers in contract form an agreement in which they pledged themselves permanently that there would be no strike. And they signed one such agreement. The West Coast, in the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the Warehouse Division, signed a permanent no-strike pledge agreement. Now, the employers of this country had other ideas. In 1945-46, after the whole period of the fraud of price control, of equality of sacrifice, of the no-strike pledge, in which the capitalists were piling up monumental profits while the wages of the workers remained frozen, the workers began to move to get some of the concessions which they felt that they were warranted in demanding because of the sacrifices they had made during the war, and a big strike wave developed, 45-46. Now, the American capitalist class thought that they could repeat the same experience the workers went through after the First World War, where the capitalist class used the returning veterans to smash the organized labor movement. The government emerged after the First World War as the spearhead of the attack against labor. In the maritime industry, I remember that in 21, the ship owners wanted to sign a contract with the unions. The government, through their Sea Service Bureau, says, if you sign a contract, we'll put you out of business. And proceeded to smash the seamen's unions, which never recovered from 1921 until 1934 in the big movement on the Pacific coast. They thought that they were going to be able to use the returning veterans as a battering ram to smash the organized labor movement in 1945-46. But their plans did not materialize, because the veterans, many of whom, most of whom were workers, in unmistakable terms demonstrated their solidarity with the strikers. And so the big strike movement of 45-46 resulted in considerable, large concessions extracted by the union from the employer and the government. This demonstrated to the employers that on the basis of their own independent action, they did not have the power to grapple with the tremendously expanded union movement that had developed in the period since 1934 and had extended its membership during the period of war, that they alone, by the use of their own forces and resources, could no longer cope with this giant union movement. And it was then that they began to resort to their control of the political apparatus, the government, through the legislation which began with the enactment of Taft-Hartley in 1947. The Taft-Hartley Act was the first of that whole series of anti-union, anti-labor legislation, which was enacted during Democratic administration, of course, with the collaboration of the Republicans, in which the government entered as the main opponent to the unions in an effort to curb their growing strength and power. And Taft-Hartley then, of course, gave birth to this whole spate of right-to-work laws, especially in all of the southern states, which were the stronghold of anti-unionism then, as they are today. Now, when the union movement, in the fight against Taft-Hartley, capitulated, again with a few notable exceptions, John L. Lewis, the International Typographical Union, and one or two others who defied the law, it was apparent to anyone who knew the role of the state in the conflict between the classes, that it would become the central axis around which would determine the course of the further development. Because many, all of them, agree that any employer who really sets out to utilize Taft-Hartley to smash a union can do so with the aid of the government. The failure of the union movement of the 30s to go beyond the trade union level, to stop short of the organization of its own political party was paid for in 47 with Taft Hartley, and they've been paying for it ever since. There can be no solution to the problem of the decline of the American trade union movement short of the organization on the political field of its own independent party, which will stand in counterposition, in conflict with the parties of the American capitalist class in a struggle for state power. And that's why this pamphlet is worthless, it's meaningless, and all of the others, because that's where they sidestep every one of them. Every one of these so-called critics remain supporters of one degree or another of the Democratic Party. They can't lead the union movement or the labor movement anywhere with that kind of a policy. You tell that to your general counsel, Morris, next time you see him. You tell him he's a fake and a fraud. This gang of bureaucrats, they don't want to fight, except some rank and file or some militant. They've gone, they're too content, too fat and satisfied. And so the fight is going to have to take place against these bureaucrats, as it did in the 30s. In the 30s, in struggle after struggle and union after union, dominated by the same kind of bureaucrats that you have today, the workers in their period of upsurge, in their period of militant movement, not only settled accounts with the employer and the state, but took care of their own bureaucrats in the bargain. I remember in San Francisco, the head of the sailors' union, a fellow by the name of Schoenberg, also head of the AFL in California, and holding some high appointed post given him by the governor, was bodily kicked down the stairs. He was bodily booted out of that union hall by the workers who had just gone through a strike and were determined to realize the benefits of their struggle and that they paid for with the blood of some of their fighting comrades. In the period of the CIO, the union movement finally broke down, or at least opened a gap, in the barrier toward Negro unionization. And they had to do it. It's not because they wanted to, they had to. Because in steel, in auto, in other big plants, it was the conscious policy of the industrialists to take advantage of the race prejudice that existed among the white workers. And in periods of strike, they would import from the South Negroes to break the strike. And many strikes were broken that way. Now, Ford had a conscious policy, not only of importing Negro workers from areas in the South, but also importing crackers, the white anti-Negro crackers of the worst varieties, and put them both in the same plant so that they would be this, what he considered, impassable barrier to their uniting. But what was demonstrated, it was during the periods of the strike and especially of the sit-down, that the solidarity of workers, both black and white, was able to overcome these prejudices and smash the anti-union front, which the employers thought that they had effectively erected. Now, there was the Negro movement in the 30s was conspicuous by its absence. There was no real organized movement such as we know today. And Negro workers were never able to win full equality, not only in the AFL, but in the CIO, and haven't to this day. But things are a lot different today. The question of whether or not the workers will move into action on the political arena does not rest entirely anymore in the hands of either the trade union bureaucrats or even the unions themselves. Already out of the ranks of the Negro freedom fighters, there is emerging this recognition of the necessity of embarking upon independent political action, that is, breaking with the Democratic Party which had gained the allegiance of a large section of the Negro population during the Roosevelt period. The recognition that their struggle also is essentially a political struggle and can be fought out and won only on the political arena. And once the Negro masses begin moving in that direction, it'll place the American labor bureaucracy and the unions in an impossible position to continue to try and maintain their coalition with the Democratic Party. Already, we see signs of stirring. Things are not so bad. The workers are not so apathetic. The union movement is not about to collapse. Oh, no, they got a long, long way. You have 17 million organized workers. Recently, we saw such demonstrations as the printer strike in New York. And these are comparatively well-paid workers, the higher level, the aristocracy of labor, conduct a militant struggle. The longshoremen who opposed the Taft-Hartley and after the 80-day period voted again to go on strike. Eric Kennedy had to intervene with his own committee, and they got substantial concessions. They got practically all they asked for under this Morse Commission, which was set up by the government, and so you can mark that down as a victory. Recently, again, in the Boeing, where the officials of the International Association of Machinists tried to sell them a contract, the workers voted it down. These are straws in the wind. The working class in this country is far from finished. These Cassandras, these prophets of doom and gloom speak correctly of the fate that awaits the labor bureaucracy. Not the union movement, not the American working class. This working class has demonstrated time and time again its capacity for struggle against the greatest odds, its ingenuity, its initiative, its self-sacrifice. And they want us to believe now that this same working class is going to take lying down the results of a policy initiated by labor's friend in the White House, which means a gradual but inevitable reduction in the standard of living of the American workers? No, we've already seen manifestations that this is not going to be true. The character of the struggles today are, in a sense, defensive. That is, the workers are attempting to defend conditions and concessions previously won against the inroads of automation, unemployment, and job security. Job security, in the 30s, recognition was the central issue. Job security today becomes the greatest issue. And it's not workers who have been beaten down by depression that respond with militant action. That was not the lesson of the 30s. And that's not true. Workers will fight much more vigorously and militantly to protect and preserve gains which had previously that they had previously made than to fight for new gains. That was demonstrated in the 116-day strike of the steelworkers, which from a half-hearted attempt on the part of McDonald to gain a few concessions was converted into probably the most massive demonstration of militant resistance on the part of the steelworkers when the employers injected the issue of work rules, that is, to take away from them conditions which had been previously established. McDonald. Oh, there is a prize. There is a prize for you. He was during this recent increase in steel prices, McDonald was soaking out his bones in Palm Springs. He has a little hacienda there that he spent $50,000 for, where he can hobnob with the Hollywood movie folk and the Kennedys and other riffraff of that kind. McDonald, who never was a steel worker. He was a pencil pusher to begin with. He was an errand boy for
Phil Murray.
He became a... It's good to have the militant editor here, you see. Supply the information. McDonald. Chicken-hearted. Spineless worm. Now, the youth played a great role in 1936 during that struggle, during that whole series of struggles. One of the reasons that the Communist Party was able to establish its control over a large section of the union movement, especially the CIO, at one time they almost had control of the whole organization, was the fact that they had the youth movement in the 30s. And when this tremendous upsurge occurred, they threw their youth into these union struggles. They weren't in the unions, they were on the campus. I knew a lot of them. There's Goldberg, who's now the big shot in the ILGWU. I knew him when he was running around the Berkeley campus selling the Workers' World. They threw them into the union because there were demands from many of our comrades entered the union movement as organizers for the first time. All over the country, you couldn't sign workers up fast enough. It was impossible to get enough organizers who could speak, who knew something. The goddamn labor faker. I know who sent you. They'll resort to any trick. Nothing's beneath them. Thanks, Nick. Sent them into these unions and made organizers, union leaders, many, many of them. When the next upsurge come, it's inevitable. It's inevitable. In my opinion, it must take the political form. All of these people talk about the organizing, you know, they select the unions, they're not organizing, they're not expanding, they're trying so forth and so on. All you need is to get out and really organize. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. It isn't a question of organizing a few more thousand workers into the unions. That's not going to solve anything. Or 10 more thousand. You know, when there was the fusion between the AFL and CIO, Many of these labor pundits said, oh, now you're going to have a big forward surge of the union movement. When you join the forces of the AFL and the forces of CIO together in one organization, 16 or 17 million strong, labor is really going to go on the move again. And at that time, we says, no, not necessarily so. The fact of the matter is that the big upsurge in the union movement came in the 30s when the split occurred, not through unification. We said the decisive question is the question of program and policy. If the AFL and CIO or the joint organization continues with its same policy and program, then the union movement cannot but decline, not grow. You go back and see some of the articles that we wrote at that period in both the magazine and in the paper. And the same is true today. You don't believe it, eh? Where can you do organizing now? Outside of little bits and pieces here and there. In the South. Can you organize in the South and support the Democratic Party at the same time? Can you launch any kind of an effective attack upon that bulwark of reaction, anti-unionism, and remain supporters of Kennedy and company? You know, Bob Kennedy keeps telling the freedom fighters in the South, the time is not opportune now. I'm for you, I'm with you, but now it's really not opportune now. Well, why don't you wait a while? In 40 years, you may have a president of these United States. If it's not 40, it'll be 400. But wait. Do you think that the Kennedy would permit the union movement to begin the kind or to conduct the kind of an organizing campaign in the South, which would amount to almost civil war just to organize those workers? Can't be done. They can't organize. They can't hold their own. They can't stop the process of decline and decay until this policy of collaboration with the Democratic Party is broken. And so we call for, now we say, that any genuine left-wing development in the union movement today must take as its absolute minimum foundation, break the coalition with the Democrats and form your own independent labor party. Fight for the 30 for 40 slogan. That's the central slogan today against unemployment and automation. Full equality for all Negro workers in the unions. You begin with that and then add your other demands. There can be no genuine left-wing development in this union movement that doesn't incorporate as its basic demand the political organization of the workers in the Independent Labor Party and equality for the Negro people and workers in the unions. Cannot be. It's only through, again, re-cementing an alliance with the Negro mass that the labor movement can begin to exercise that social vision and that crusading spirit that will rally the overwhelming majority of the American people to its banner, if its object is to take the power in this country and to utilize that power for the good of the many, except instead of for the profit of the few. And that's the job, our job, in the union movement today. And we are completely optimistic that this American working class, once it begins to move, will roll over these bureaucrats as they did in the first, through the barrier elected by the Communist and Socialist Party. And we have every reason for optimism, because today the Socialist Workers' Party, Trotskyists, have the cream of the youth in its youth organization. We're just beginning. But already we have a great advantage over every other radical tendency. The youth is coming to Trotskyism, not to the worn-out betrayers of socialism, the Stalinists or the Yipsels, who try to juggle between radicalism and conservatism. And don't any of you comrades here have any doubt that when these developments occur, that you will not be able to find some place in this movement. We won't have enough youth to fill the demands for young, socialist-conscious, labor-minded young people with the energy and the willingness to fight on the basis of a class struggle line for power, because the youth are going to get it in the neck. They're getting it now. Millions who are turned out every year can find no place in the economy of the country. They're beginning to grope for ideas and solutions. They're not going to find it in Donner or Meany or Reuther, not even in Norman Thomas, but in the program of the Socialist Workers' Party and the Young Socialist Alliance.